I want to welcome you. We at Torah in Motion are once again proud to be hosting a program in Holocaust Education Week, a part of the wide array of programming we do all through the year, scholars in residence, Tisha B'Av, medical ethics, Tanakh, et cetera, if you want to see. We have hundreds of our past programs on our website, MP3s of all our past lectures, our non-Shabbos, you know, past lectures. But in 2011, we began running, trips, Jewish history trips, heritage trips. And last year we traveled, we were in Poland, and this past summer we were in Germany. And to say that those trips transformed my life would be really an understatement. I guess I'm fortunate in a way that I come from a family that came to these shores in the early 1900s and don't really have a direct link to the Holocaust. Many of my friends do, and really, even though I studied it and I know a lot of survivors, to actually see it was quite extremely powerful. And really, the one thought that came to me when I was in Auschwitz, and I said, I don't know how somebody could live 1 hour in this place. It's just unbelievable. And to think that there are people who spent, months there is beyond belief. And sort of the awe that I developed for anybody who survived was very, very, powerful. And how they built, and so many of the people who survived have built like wonderful lives. And despite the horrors they went through. And really, this evening we're gonna talk about on the memories and how do we deal with all the memories that people went through, those who survived and their children. And I don't have to tell anybody in this room, we're in the last few years that we're actually going to be able to talk and see any survivors. Our children won't know in 10 years they're not going to be anybody left. So that's a little bit of a scary thought, but it's a powerful thought. And with that, really, Wei, I'll introduce Dr. Malamud, who will be running the program. Thank you very much.
Hi, good evening. So every year on Yom HaShoah, Israel comes to a standstill for 2 minutes. There are air raid sirens, and they blare across the country, and pedestrians stop in their tracks, and drivers exit their vehicles and bow their heads to honor the 6 million victims of Nazi genocide. Those 2 minutes are a brief moment to remember the victims and the suffering of that period. But for Holocaust survivors, painful memories linger year-round, haunting their days and nights. Such agonizing memories are not limited to those who survived the Holocaust, but are suffered by millions of people the world over who have undergone traumatic experiences. But would it be possible to recall events without the associative pain that accompanies those memories? Our guest this evening, Dr. Daniela Schiller, herself the child of a Holocaust survivor, is involved in cutting-edge research designed to explore that very question. Dr. Schiller was born in Israel. She earned a PhD in cognitive neuroscience from Tel Aviv University. In 2004, she began working as a postdoctoral fellow at New York University. Her work has been published in numerous scholarly journals, including the Journal of Neuroscience and the Journal of Psychiatric Research. And she's the recipient of multiple awards, including the New York Academy of Sciences Award for Young Scientists for her research on how to rewire the brain to eradicate fear as a response to memory. In 2010, she became a professor at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City, where she directed the Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience Laboratory. She thereafter began utilizing MRIs to scan the human brain to identify the neurological links between fear and memory. Not least importantly, Dr. Schiller has performed as a drummer for the Amygdaloids, an American rock band composed of New York University professors. Please welcome Daniela Schiller. Okay, let's do some groundwork here, Daniela. Many of us have a perception of how memory works that might be inaccurate, right? We think of memory, we think of like it's an object that you put in a drawer or a file in a cabinet, And the trick is just to be able to retrieve it from the drawer. But your research and those of others indicate that the way memory operates is actually much more complicated and fluid, and that memories are more malleable, as it were. Can you explain to us what this means?
Yeah, so we actually, that was our perception for a whole century. So the 20th century was dominated by this idea of the consolidation theory. What does consolidation mean? It means that there is a process in the brain, a biological process, whereby events are being stored, carved into the brain, and you can identify it. So we have nerve cells, and the nerve cells fire, and when there's a new event, the connection between the cells in the brain changes. And scientists noticed that this happens when we remember. So for example, an event like tonight will be encoded in your brain, will undergo this process that we call consolidation, and then you will remember. The thing is that for the entire century, we thought that this is a one-time process. So memories are being stored in the brain once, and then you retrieve them, and each time you retrieve the original memory. So we thought it's a one-time process, and we thought that once memories are formed, they're accurate, and we always retrieve the same memory. But then in 2000, there was a few seminal studies, a very important study that triggered a very fruitful line of research. And what this research discovered is that this is not a one-time process. It's not that you store the memory once and then you retrieve the same memory. Actually, each time you retrieve your memory, you have to store it again. It has to undergo consolidation again. And this is why we call it reconsolidation. It just means that it has to be to undergo this biological process, something very similar like encoding the original event. You have to encode it each time you retrieve it. So what does it mean? It means that there's a window of vulnerability. It means that each time you retrieve a memory, because it has to be stored again, there's an opportunity for modification. And this gave the idea that memories are actually dynamic. It's not that you have one event that is being stored and then you keep retrieving the same memory. Actually, memories is something that changes between active and inactive. So sometimes it's dormant, you don't think about it, and then it becomes active in your brain. And then you have to store it again, and then it becomes active, and so forth. So memory is a dynamic process, as opposed to this one-time consolidation process.
So if we were to take what you're saying and plug back into the metaphor I began with. So we used to think there's one drawer and there's one file. You take the file, you stick it in the drawer, and every time you just take it out. But what you're saying is, every time you take the file out, you're kind of having to put it back, and you're maybe putting it in a new drawer, and you're maybe playing a little bit with the papers in the file, perhaps, that it isn't exact same file that you're sticking back.
Yeah, so here the metaphor becomes even slightly more complicated, because it's not really that there is a file at all. Memories are not stored as one sorted file. They're actually fragmented, and the act of remembering is an act of reconstruction. You take all these fragments and you reconstruct them into a coherent narrative. So it's like you had many things sorted, spread in your room, and when you retrieve it, you just hook them together into one construct, and then they go into their separate segments again.
Does that mean that literally each part of the memory has to be brought in like a puzzle?
Yes.
So
yes. Let's
say you had a memory of your father, your mother, at a lake with a house and trees. So you have to retrieve your father, you have to retrieve your mother, you have to retrieve the lake, you have to retrieve the house. So the more complex the memory, there's all these retrievals going on. And each time you retrieve, you're redoing the puzzle slightly
or a lot,
right? Yeah. So you're involved. So what you're saying then is, in a sense, that memory is not just this one sort of trace that you leave in the mm-hmm. brain, like a neural footprint. It's really almost like a work of art, almost like something that's continually in process and being updated. And you can have like second and third and 10th and infinite drafts of these memories. So if that's the case, what you're arguing then is that in a traumatic situation, the person's going back and they're retrieving all these pieces of the puzzle, right? And you're saying that that retrieval moment or series of moments is in a way a vulnerable moment because it's fluid. Like, are they going to put all the puzzle pieces together in exactly the same way? Mm-hmm. And you're saying that that's the moment where you can actually go to work and try and help them shape their memory. Can you explain how that works, like the research you're actually doing in the lab that's talking about that process?
Yeah, in the lab, we're doing very simple experiments that are actually nothing like our real life memory, but they allow us to isolate the very basic components of memory. So what we would do is do something very simple. So we would take a visual stimulus, for example, present like a colored square on the computer, you know, a blue square or a yellow square. And so imagine you're sitting in front of a computer and I'm hooking you up to electrodes. So you have electrodes on your fingers and the electrodes on the fingers measure how much you sweat. So if you're excited. And then there's another small electrode here, and the electrode delivers an electric shock. So it sounds horrible, but it's actually, it's just slightly unpleasant. And if you're a participant in the experiment, you set the level yourself. So you just say, okay, it's a little bit unpleasant. And that's how we measure your expectation to get this unpleasant thing that we deliver to your hand. So what people learn in the course of the experiment is that whenever they see, for example, a blue square, they will get a shock. But if they see a yellow square, they don't. And that's it. It's called classical conditioning or Pavlovian conditioning, which most of you probably are familiar with that. Pavlov discovered in 1927. So we use this very simple process, and people who do, we do it in humans, human participants. But people who do animal research on these same circuits use exactly the same procedure so we can compare across species. So what happens is that you were in the laboratory, you learn to be afraid of the blue square, and then I'll invite you the next day and you'll see the blue square. And that's it. That's really what it means to reactivate the fear memory. When you see the blue square, you remember the shock and you get kind of slightly aroused. And if we scan your brain at the same time and measure and assess your behavior and your responses, we can track your fear response and how the brain reacts to that. At this point, you can sometimes give a particular drug that is used to block the restorage of that memory, and we see how it interferes. Or we can provide new information, something safe. And then when the memory is being stored again, it's being incorporated into your original memory. And then a day later, we will test your reactions again. So it's a very simple analytic process that we, with which we try to isolate the different components of memory.
So this is the part I'm trying to understand, right? So you've developed this association, as many people do with their memories, mm-hmm. that every time I put that puzzle together in this way, I'm going to feel X. I'm going to feel fear or dread or whatever it is. So what you're saying is that you're trying to initiate a process in the middle of that sort of sequence where I've put this puzzle together and I'm about to feel fear, but I'm going to do something to stop this automatic response between these puzzle pieces and that emotion. Mm-hmm. So are you saying that the thing that you introduce actually stops the person from feeling that emotion the next time around?
Yeah, the process I'm describing is of emotional memories. So it's not about erasing the content or even confusing the content. It's about the emotional response. The update is of the emotional response. There are studies on non-emotional memories that show that the same principles also operate. And we might confuse the content also.
So that seems remarkable to me. You're not altering the content. So let's think about trauma, right? And the person was the victim of a terrible event, whether it was in the Holocaust or rape or some horrible traumatic event. It seems almost unbelievable that you could recall that content and now not have a negative association. So what replaces it actually? What are you now feeling? You're imagining yourself back in the camp or back when you were assaulted, same content, and now what's the association at that point?
It's a very, well, it's a complicated question. It's a deep ethical question, right? I think it's what we are aspiring for is to make traumatic memories similar to regular memories. And, you know, we all have positive and negative events in our lives. And they used to be incredibly happy or incredibly sad. But now, as time goes by, so we are a little bit detached, right? And when we retrieve these memories, we know that they belong to the past. There's a separation between the present and the past. And our emotions, even if they are being triggered, they are manageable. And this is what we aspire for. So it's not, the goal is not to be flat. What happens with traumatic memories is that they severely interfere with your adaptive function. They attack you, you're right. Unable to leave your home, you suffer. And this is what we want to fix. So there will remain an emotional response, but it will be manageable.
So you're saying it's certainly not erasure.
Yes.
It's not elimination. It's maybe taking the edge off a little bit from the power of that reflexive trauma association so that it can be regulated.
Yeah, one way to call it is update. It's really to update the emotional meaning.
What do you mean by that?
That it doesn't have the same meaning, the experience, the emotional meaning. So, for example, you can feel dread. You can be terrified, but after a while, it wouldn't be as terrifying, and it wouldn't feel as if it's happening at the moment. The interesting thing about emotional memories is that they're almost like time travel, because if they're extremely strong, you feel now just as you felt in the past, or even not. They might even develop later. But there are certain time travel, they make you feel now as if the event is happening now, although it's a memory. And the idea is to create that separation.
Right, so you're trying to... In a sense, it's not eliminating that this happened. It happened. And it's not eliminating the fact that at the time it was horrifying. But you're creating a kind of a proportional time sequence. It is now 40 years or 60 years since that event. And I'm not going to think about it as if I am reliving this every day. Not that I'm going to forget about it. I'm never going to forget about it. But it's not going to have quite the same overwhelming power that it would as if it was today, which strikes me as something that's true of a lot of memories, even what we'd call ordinarily sad events, like people who can't get over a breakup, let's say, and it's been 5 years and it feels like it's yesterday. So it's the same sort of process. You mentioned that there's an ethical issue here. What do you see as the ethical complication?
I mean, a lot of people raise the concern that, well, if it's not going to feel that bad, how can we prosecute someone who offended us and so forth? And it's a complicated question, but the way I think about it is that well, if you have, for example, well, if someone hurts you, like violently attacks you and let's say break your arm, this is totally curable, right? You know, after a few weeks, your arm will be good as new. Still, you will prosecute the person, and it's very clear that that person shouldn't have attacked you. So I think about it the same way, that if someone caused you a severe mental trauma, even that you go back to regular adaptive function, it still shouldn't have happened, and right. You still suffered for a period, but at least it's curable. So the idea about traumatic memories is that it's not something really that you want to keep or endure. It severely affects your function. You're just unable to function. So just as we want to heal physically, we want to heal mentally. And that's how I think about
so
it.
So recreating this puzzle, in a sense, will allow people to move just a little bit more forward.
Live
than they were to
they
live.
They will get will get their lives back. Otherwise, you're just captive in your memories. So.
Are you open to questions?
At the end, we'll have questions at the end. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You've written about what makes storytelling so powerful, as the act of sharing. It's therapeutic. One person has a narrative, they tell it to somebody else, and in the act of sharing it, it becomes something that they both can now hold up, can share the weight of, as it were. But you note, quote, that the problem with many veterans and people with trauma is that they cannot share their memories for fear of the gap between their experience and our understanding. Meaning that a lot of the problem with trauma is also the isolation, that the person feels that you'll never get what it is that I'm going to say to you. Is there any way of overcoming that? Is there a way of being able to bridge that isolation?
Yeah, I think art is a very powerful tool. I was exposed and experienced a little bit the art of storytelling, and that's a very powerful way for people to share their sometimes horrific events, but it goes through some translation into something that you can share and still get people emotional about it, and it's still separate from you. But you just turn it into a form that people can share and understand and experience. Well, you're a little bit protected because right. You put something outside of you in this form of art, and that helps. It's like a bridge. But isolation in memory is, I think, one of the major problems.
When you do your work, what's been the when you do it with your human subjects that you talked about in the laboratory? Have those subjects been Holocaust survivors or not survivors?
The research I do is on just healthy volunteers, usually students, because we study these basic processes of memory. But now we have some studies in patients, veterans with PTSD. And we try to see if the mechanisms, these basic mechanisms that we identified in animals and healthy humans that just undergo these simple experiences in the lab, we want to see if what we learned about fear extends to these patients.
What have you learned so far?
It's actually, I don't have the results yet. Uh-huh. It's still, we call it translation, you know, translating from basic neuroscience to clinical applications takes a long time. And the study of reconsolidation and all these discoveries about memory that I just described are fairly new. Since 2000, it's just been... well, 16 years, but from the very first study that kind of started the whole. So it's a short period in scientific terms. And we just start to see this translation into clinical studies, and I think the next 3 years is going to be interesting.
I guess I was wondering if your subjects were skeptical. In other words, if you were to tell your research to somebody with PTSD or a survivor and say, well, what we're going to try and do is we're going to try and make you not feel that way about your memory, how do they react to that, or how would they respond to that?
Well, I think actually a lot of the therapies that currently exist in a way capture that. The most effective therapy that we have is exposure therapy, or people also know it as CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. So people come to the therapist or the clinician, and they have to talk about their trauma again and again, repeatedly. And in the laboratory, we have an equivalent, and we call it extinction training. This is, let's say, if you take the blue square, then you present it again and again until your fear dissipates. But they do something else in the clinic after they repeat the memory. They also do some processing. So they ask them to retell it, rescript it, think about it sometimes like a movie. They ask to think about it with a different ending, from a different perspective, and that's processing. So I think that some therapies, to some extent, already capture that process that we discovered now at the biological level. Okay.
Yep.
So I think the existing therapies may already capture that, but we need to see the merging between therapy and the neuroscience.
Do you believe that the telling is the healing? In other words, there are many people who grew up with survivor parents, at this point survivor, you know, grandparents, let's say. There's no single way of characterizing what their reaction is going to be to what they went through, and some are more talkative, some are utterly silent. Many people you speak to said, you know, my parents never spoke about it, and we'll talk about your dad in a few minutes. Do you have a philosophy that speaking of it is a form of healing as opposed to not speaking of it?
I think it depends. I don't think there's one definite answer. Suppression, in a way, is a healthy mechanism. I mean, we have it, it's adaptive. It protects us. And the idea of retrieving the memories and talking about them is to give the memory opportunity to be connected to the present. That's the idea of updating. But I think some experiences are just too horrific in a way. And some memories, for some memories, it might be just impossible to weave them into the future, so into the present. So I think it depends on the person and on the memory and on the present environment, and the combination and collaboration between all of these aspects may allow for someone to bring a very difficult memory into the present and try to live with it and weave it into the present. But for some, it might be easier to suppress. I think the question in each case is, what is the price? Suppression comes with a price. It's very effortful, and you would see with the person that suppresses, you would see the price. But also bringing the memory comes with a price. And I think every person has to weigh.
And it's a price that others would pay as well, I assume. In other words, that suppression or that narrative would leak out and affect all of the dynamics inside of the family, and probably family members have vote differently about whether it should be suppressed or narrated. I know that in your own case, you had that sort of ongoing narrative in your own family, and I wanted to talk to you a bit about how your family history relates to your research. In 1942, at the age of 15, your father, Sigmund Schilder, was captured by the Germans. He was sent to a labor camp, I think it was near Tlust, which I think is in the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And you've said that when you were growing up, your dad never, I think that means like never, right, spoke about his time in the camp. And you would ask him time and again, right, all through childhood, growing up, even into adulthood, right? And he would say nothing, right? So when he said nothing, meaning you would ask him, like, Dad, can you sit it? And he would be silent, or he would say no, or he wouldn't even open his mouth. That would be it. He'd just look at you, silent, that was it, right? Silence is a very powerful thing, right? Because it must have made you wonder exactly what his experience was. So the suppression that takes place inside of the family also causes great curiosity for everybody left, because they want to know. I'm wondering if you think your father's silence was formative for you in terms of your choice of the career, you know, trying to figure out what goes on in the brain, and the desire to see what people remember or don't remember.
Yeah, my father's silence was very powerful, and as a kid, I was always curious and intimidated by it, because, you know, when someone never talks, your imagination is probably worse than reality, although in this case, there's it's kind of hard to imagine something worse. But yeah, you live with a lot of difficult speculations. And I ended up studying memories. It wasn't intentional. I always separated my scientific life from my private life. I actually never made the connection. Only a few years ago, when I was asked to actually tell a story that links something personal with science, I just kind of made the link. But it was never explicit. But in retrospect, it makes a lot of sense.
Right, that it was pushing you that way. So then a filmmaker named Lirone Unreich, who created something called the Ripple Project. What the Ripple Project is it explores the multi-generational effects of the Holocaust. So he comes to your parents' house in Rishon LeZion, and your father began to talk to him about things he'd never spoken of his whole life, right? He was how old at this point?
86.
86, right. And your father passed away 2 years ago. And this was when did the filming take place?
In 2000, so that was 4 years ago. So 2 years before.
So 2 years before, okay. Why do you think your dad began to talk at that moment after so many years of silence?
I think it was a combination of things. So I kept harassing him, and he kept telling me just leave me alone. But as I kind of matured, became a woman in a way, and we had more and more conversations. I think that there were occasions where he kind of had a glimpse that I actually understand what he's saying. You know, it was that he was that isolated in his memories that he didn't even bother to tell anybody because he thought no one would understand it, and he also thought he would be pathetic. And that's pretty amazing to hear from someone who survived. He thought he just had very, in his mind, his memories were very small and simple of little moments. He didn't have big memories to tell, you know, like gas and Auschwitz. And he said, yeah, of course it happened, but these weren't the significant memories. And when he told, sometimes mentioned very little things, and I think I reacted in a certain way that made him realize that maybe I could understand. It was just very brief moments. So that was one aspect. The other is that when we had the director and the photographer, they had their own rapport with my father, and he trusted them. And in a way, when he first spoke in front of the camera, and then we had 3 days of conversations, most of the conversations were between them, and I was just there. But it was easier to talk to someone else than to me.
Hmm.
So they really provided a channel of communication.
What was that like for you?
Life-changing. I couldn't be more grateful. It was in the nick of time. Was in a moment where I just gave up. I mean, I would have conversation with my father saying, well, you know, you're going to die. And I was talking kind of directly about, and he was direct also. It was just like cynical that way. I kind of accepted that maybe he'll just never talk. And then in that just really nick of time toward the end of his life, something happened and we got this amazing gift. That changed everything, really.
Did your father find this therapeutic?
Not that he would admit. We kind of, in the movies, sometimes you have these amazing moments, and that truly was an amazing moment that was actually caught on camera. And you think that everything is going to change, but actually everything went back to the same old conversation, same old quiet moments, because... these are things, it was a moment of revelation and discussion, but it's still not a thing you can
talk about.
Yeah. You can't really bring these memories every day, but at least it was that precious moment.
So you're saying the door opened once and then it closed again.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
There's a really, there's a very powerful moment that takes place on camera between you and your father, because he's revealing details that you'd never heard before, including the existence of his sister, whom nobody in the family even knew of, right? Not you, not even your mother knew about her. That in fact that you did have this aunt and she didn't survive, whom your dad says was amazing. And then you asked your dad if he deliberately suppressed these facts, and he said, yes, you must suppress. Without suppression, I wouldn't live. And you then tell him that in your research, you've learned, quote, that it is good to cry, to bring back memories and relive them. But as soon as you say that, he shakes his head and he stops talking. So do you feel that he fundamentally disagrees with you on this point?
Yes. He thinks very strongly about suppression. After hearing his memories firsthand, it changed my mind a little bit about suppression. I understood why he suppressed, and I think I would suppress also. And That's what made the shift between, okay, suppression sometimes can be good for you. And that's why my view of it became a little bit more complex, in the sense that you need to weigh why sometimes you would suppress and sometimes not. You have to see what is the best solution for you.
So it's a very thin line then. And you have to decide, is this person going to be helped by speaking? If you were an ordinary person and you were dealing with somebody, just talking, your friend has undergone trauma, how do you weigh that in the moment? How do you decide it'd be good for you to talk it out, or I respect your boundaries and it's better for you not to say anything?
It's the delicate process that a therapist, would know, we'd experience know how to read these subtle hints of when is it safe or not, when do you go to places that you're not supposed to go. And I think it's also dynamic. Sometimes you try a little bit and then retreat. Also, when I was talking to my father, you still, even that he agrees to talk finally, you still don't know what you're allowed. And sometimes you're afraid to ask the questions, and you need courage yourself to go into this place and have courage to ask and then see what happens.
Right.
And if he doesn't want to talk, he wouldn't. So it's a very kind of like a dense type of process.
When your dad took out that memory, right, that was probably... So we don't actually know how much his whole life he was replaying because he wouldn't talk about it. Do you have a sense? So we do know that he talked about it on camera. So at that moment, he was redoing the puzzle. Do you think his puzzle was different after that, like for himself?
Probably, because it was related to this conversation and to the movie, and that's part of the healing process. This is why I'm a big believer in these artistic processes, because if you turn it into something beautiful or something that you would have never done otherwise, and it's about sharing and acceptance, and it becomes art. It gets qualities that it didn't have before, and it changes it.
Hmm.
So I think in a way, and also the connection between us was slightly modified.
How so?
Well, we talked about it. So
you talked about it at that time, and
yeah.
But afterwards, not.
I just told him about what I did with these memories, you know, because we created this documentary and kind of I gave him an updates and stuff. But and we had a few more conversations, but in a way, you kind of want to leave it behind and be in the present and enjoy the present. And now you're allowed, it's a little bit less heavier, you know, without this black box.
And for your mother, what was it like?
Different. They have their own their own relationship, which is kind of a whole different story.
I'm just going to ask a couple of more things, and I'm happy for questions to come from the floor. We're gonna bring the mic out here, and if you want to ask a question, you should step up to the mic. I want to understand, finally, just a little bit more about the actual cognitive aspect here. I'm assuming there are like different kinds of memories, like not all memories are the same. There are memories about past events. There are memories about skills, I guess, that you've learned, like riding a bike. And there are memories that will trigger an emotion, like, I shouldn't put my hand on the stove because I remember that it burned, and so on. Are those memories in different parts of the brain?
Yeah, different parts of the brain mediate these different memory systems. You mentioned procedural memory that involves motor actions, the motor cortex.
Like riding the bike.
Yeah, like playing the piano. There's episodic memories, which is the memory we're all familiar with of episodes in our life. But there's also semantic memory, which is just a memory of facts, like what year something happened. And we have the emotional memories, and different circuits of the brain underlie these different systems. But they're also within every memory, there are also levels or layers, because there's the conscious layer, which is your ability to report. And there's the unconscious processing that is going on that is also part of the memory. And these different aspects have different processing in the brain.
When people have brain injury, let's say they have stroke or something similar, it's possible that some parts of the brain are affected and other parts aren't, which is why their memory is fragmented. In other words, because the piece of the brain that has one kind of memory is still working, the other part is not working.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Yeah, sometimes there are the famous cases of patients where they kind of cut their brain into two because they had epilepsy and they didn't want the epilepsy to spread. So they just separated the two hemispheres, and one is related to language and the other isn't. And actually my former mentor did these classic experiments where they kind of blocked their view and they projected, for example, they saw objects that went into one side of the brain and they had to report what they did from what they saw on the other side of the brain. So basically what they found is that even that they couldn't tell why they were doing something, they were still doing it, and then they will just confabulate. So you would see this kind of sometimes in certain situation with patients, you could create a disconnect and kind of see the separate function of these different types of processes.
Okay. I think there were people wanted to ask questions from the floor, so I'm going to ask them to step up to the mic here.
When your father was recalling these memories for the documentary, what was his emotional state? What emotions was he displaying attached to those memories at that time?
Well, it's the first time I actually see him cry, but in a way that not like crying, but you know, that you see some slight kind of emotion in the eyes, and the voice was shivering, and sometimes it was hard for him to speak, and that was kind of the most emotional I've seen him. So he actually said in the documentary, he said, the reason I don't talk is that if I'll talk, I'll cry. So he definitely expressed emotion. Yeah.
Did the crying for him meant being overwhelmed now? In other words, the suppression is no longer working and it's not manageable? Is that what it meant for him?
Well, he did it. It was still very subtle. He wasn't kind of falling apart at all, but I think he wasn't used to that. And in this sense, it was somewhat overwhelming. But the more I visited, and sometimes, you know, I would just arrive into the house and it would just like immediately get, so I became the cue.
You're the trigger for the tears now.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Do you think his technique worked all those years? In other words, did suppression serve him well and allow him to live, or do you think it blocked part of the living for him?
I think it served him well. I think, yeah, he had, you know, managed to have a wonderful family, you know, seven grandkids, even he lived to see grandkids. And once he spoke about the memories, I understood why he never spoke about them. I mean, they sent us in school, you know, when you're kind of in grade school, and you need to write and do the family tree and ask these, and he constantly refused me, and now I understand. I mean, I would never tell these memories into a 7-year-old or an 11-year-old even, or any year
old. Right, you came home with a school project one day when you were, right, it was in the 6th grade, I think, or?
Yeah, but kind of every grade almost. But
so, and he said no, you were upset probably at the time.
Yeah, and only in when we talked during the documentary work, he said, you know, if kids are interested, it shouldn't be a school assignment. although I sometimes use the school assignment as an excuse, right. Like, well, maybe if it's a school assignment, we would talk.
It'll,
you
talk
know,
to
it's,
me.
It's
right.
Just this funny right. exchange.
Does any of your research deal with dreams or nightmares? And if so, can you get healing process through doing research on it and hearing what people think? And
This is a really wonderful question. It's one of the biggest mysteries. I don't think we really have a good understanding of why we dream and how dream works, but there's definitely nightmares and some studies about certain drugs that help, that do affect how memories are being stored in the brain and consolidated. It could be that the way memories are being stored in the brain is slightly different during sleep. And then maybe it's even an opportunity to affect them, or maybe some of these mechanisms are slightly different and this is why you have nightmares. But at this point, it's all trial and error, and people try different drugs. I hope that maybe in the future, when we understand better how memories are formed, we would also be able to track that process during sleep and see why people relive these memories during sleep.
If it's possible to reduce the negative psychological effects of traumatic memories, and I know someone who would benefit from that, but they wouldn't go to a therapist, can you briefly describe what the steps would be?
It's about, this is a risky response from my perspective, because I'm not a therapist, so I could just guess or kind of for just from a non-specialist, but the idea is to retrieve the memory, and it means to feel it. So you have to allow the emotion to happen, and then either you allow it and then accept it as part of the presence. Some therapies are called acceptance therapy, and this is what they're focused on. And the other is to do something with it, either through conversation. And here there are many options, and many therapies suggest that. For example, some people think about it like a movie and they want you to rewind it. And that allows you to have some control over the memory and see that you're actually able to modify it. Another is to do something artistic with it. And another is just to allow it, which is what they do in exposure therapy. It's just you get used to retrieving it and leaving the emotion until the emotions become gradually reduced. So all of these options are, but the idea is about this dynamic processing of retrieving the memory, and then something positive happens.
Can I ask one more? If traumatic memories are so vulnerable to being modified each time you think of them, so how can a victim ever be believed in a court sort of situation?
Yeah, that's a critical question. And actually, before these discoveries in neuroscience, there was a lot of research 30, 40 years ago by especially Elizabeth Loftus from Boston University, that she did groundbreaking research in psychology about eyewitness testimony. And she did exactly these experiments showing that the way people question a witness can modify what the witness remembers. So for example, she did this very simple experiment. So for example, you witness an accident, and if I'll ask you, how fast did the car arrived to the stop sign? And then you will try, you will answer that. But if I will ask you, how slow did the car arrive to the crossroad? Then you see, I modified the details a little bit, and just by modifying the details, I could plant information in the way you reconstruct the memory. So you will envision a stop sign, and you will imagine the car driving faster. So all these details can affect the way you reconstruct the memory. An interesting question is how it applies to traumatic memories. What Elizabeth Loftus and others have shown is that this is how regular memories work, and that's why they're not reliable. And this has to be carefully considered in courts and the way in police investigations and so forth. With traumatic memories, there are actually two options exist. Either they've never been reconsolidated, and actually you do relive the original event. They're just rigid and inflexible like regular memories, or that they've been amplified, so became overly emotional. And science currently works under the premise that actually they've probably been amplified and it's like a snowball. So you retrieve it and you're more emotional, so it becomes stronger and stronger each time. But what exactly is happening with traumatic memories compared to the way regular memories work, we still don't know for sure.
Is there a difference between a memory which you think you had and which you're convinced you had and an actual memory? I've spoken to some survivors, and I mean this with the utmost respect, I really do, who claim certain things have happened to them and are absolutely convinced that it did. But on further questioning, they couldn't have been at that particular camp at that time. Mm-hmm. But they are convinced that it was so. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I respect that memory. Mm-hmm. What I'm asking is, has that got the same veracity as an actual memory?
I think people are trying to identify that in the brain to find a correlate or a neural correlate, we call it, of an actual memory, and people are still searching to try to prove or try to find what is the signature of a real memory. Sometimes you can show that in very, very simple memories, in the, for example, animal brain, if you do very simple studies. But for actual real day, everyday memories, I don't think we can tell the difference. And you mentioned survivors. I don't think it applies. It might apply. I mean, you probably have this question because you heard. But I think we can, each one of us can question ourselves what is real in our memories and what not. And there's something really interesting about memory is that we are all very confident in our memories, or at least in some memories we're very confident, but we are not scientists in everyday life. And actually we never tested it. And sometimes if you will take two people who were in the same trip together and they will finally sit and compare experiences, everybody will have a completely different experience. And sometimes we borrow memories, especially couples that live many years together. Someone else's memory becomes your memory. So what's real? Yeah, I think we don't, it didn't kind of trickle to the general public yet, but what I feel is that what we gradually start to learn about memory maybe will inform kind of a cultural change in how we treat memories and the role of memory in our lives. I think it will become something different. It will be, we'll stop treating it as a recording and more of as a useful tool to just understand the present and make decisions to the future, but not rely it as a recording device.
Thank you so much for your presentation and your brave sharing. I'm trying to synthesize some of the things that you've said with some of the things that have been also much vaunted. And I can see some overlap, and I'm bringing in something I know you're aware of, like the eye motion movement that is brought in to sort of pretend that you're watching this terrible trauma as a movie, and to soften the memory, as you mentioned, into more of a regular memory, not denying for one second that it happened. Mm-hmm. Could you explain, because I think that the brain pathways are still not well understood.
Yeah, I think this is a great example for a therapy that people who work with patients developed. And it hasn't been tested scientifically yet, but it is very likely that it operates on these principles that we understand now about memory, which is you retrieve the memory,
it's active in the brain, and now you do this reprocessing, and when the memory is being stored, it is being stored slightly differently. And in this case, they use this rescripting technique. But
clarify that? Are we talking about EMDR here, or what? Yeah. So could you explain what that is to the audience?
Yeah, in EMDR, what they ask is for the participants to for the patients to think about their trauma and kind of actually they spend a few minutes retrieving it. And then they ask them to track their finger, for example, or sometimes they tap on the. So they do this kind of synchronous movement, either tracking a finger so they move their eyes, or do tapping. So something kind of that activates both sides. And that's pretty much it. It sounds weird and a little bit voodoo, but it works. And even at the VA, at the Veterans Hospital, they actually use this technique or refer patients. A lot of people describe that it's pretty useful. But what you can see is that it's again the same idea that you retrieve a memory and then you do something. And in this case, they do the eye movements and people are still trying to look at what is actually happening. There's also even a study that they asked people to retrieve a memory and then they asked them to play the game Tetris. You know Tetris? Even that, it's this computer game from the 80s or 70s or something. So even that, but you can see that there are a lot of aspects in the game. So it's something motor that you do, but it's also something rewarding. And there are many, many versions of that. But the common denominator across all these approaches is that it's about, again, retrieving the memory. This seems to be key. And then once the memory is active, whatever happens later allows for this modification.
Well, there seems to be also a denominator of disruption, yes. Right? Like you're retrieving and then you're disrupting the puzzle pattern slightly, and that leads to a different emotional association. Can we erase memory? In other words, you know, there's this you know, legendary movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, right, where he keeps erasing memories of the relationship. Can we actually do that in real life?
I don't think people discovered specific memories. There are definitely studies on how memory works in general, and there are particular even molecules that very specific components of memory that if you block them, you erase all memory. So this you can do.
Right.
You can erase all memory. Right. But targeting specific memories and completely erasing them, we don't have that technique yet.
Chaval.
First of all, I'd like to say this whole presentation is so fascinating. Everybody's all captivated here. I can see by the faces. As a first-generation Canadian and child of both Holocaust survivors, I was so empathizing with you, everything that you went through. And my question has to do with triggers. So growing up, we were and were not allowed to do certain things in our house. We weren't allowed to, I wasn't allowed to have a dog. I wasn't allowed to wear yellow. I was only allowed to take a bath, never shower. We never yelled, things like that. So it was only till I became, quote unquote, an adult, and I question that, till my father really opened up and said, this is what I'd like to talk about, but it's still suppressed. Do those triggers lessen as the survivor ages? I'm tippy-toeing around my parents. Well, one is deceased and one is still with me, thank God. I'm still tippy-toeing around him. Don't buy him a striped shirt for Father's Day. You know, those type of things. Don't yell, don't get upset. Be respectful because, you know, Canada is a godsend. He always says, be grateful. I just want to do the right thing. Could you help me?
Thank you very much for sharing that. This is very moving. I think that there are several important things that you're describing here. So one is that even without the verbal description or the actual conscious conversation, the trauma does being passed on from one generation to the other, even without words. So you learned that. This is implicit learning. In scientific terms, we would call it implicit learning. And that's what happened to you. You actually did inherited their trauma through these nonverbal processes. And you describe it really in a moving way. And the triggers are exactly what brings up memory. And it's even what we use in the lab, like the blue square, you know. So you had your yellow square and the bathroom. And the way to modify the memory is to reassociate the triggers. So you actually do take these triggers. When I talk about the reactivation of the memory, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the triggers, really. It's bringing these triggers, but associating them with something else. And this requires a lot of work in that case. It's about, buying a striped shirt and just, and having a birthday. But it's a very, it's a complex, long process and kind of have to choose and to work with that. But that would be the way to do it.
I'm thinking of some books that I've read recently by a Dr. John E. Sarno. Have you heard of his work? He was a doctor who had a pain clinic in Manhattan, and he talked about his type of therapy in freeing people from their traumas, and said. He wrote a book called Healing Back Pain and the Divided Mind. And he came up with the idea that the brain was so powerful that it would rather give the body a disease or pain rather than remember the traumas. And his therapy dealt with, you know, some of the things you were talking about, having people release their traumatic memories. And as even reading the book, apparently some people were healed when they realized that there was a mind-body connection. And I'm just wondering if this is still a viable idea. This was, he's a bit in his 90s, I think, today. And he wrote these books a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a very viable idea and also resonates with Freudian ideas. It could be an explanation for something as simple as phobia. Sometimes we think that we are afraid of flies or snakes or whatever, blood. A possible theory is that it actually reflects a different fear. It's just been translated into something that is contained and manageable, and that could be an explanation for something as simple as phobia. So, these are very complex processes that we're far from understanding them scientifically, but we are, at least in scientific terms, we're kind of trying now study these different levels of fear. One is the conscious level and one is the unconscious level, and see, at least in the brain, what are the processing that refer to each level. And maybe we can kind of begin this like really small steps toward understanding this complexity of how we translate something that we don't want to experience into something that we give it a completely different meaning in disguise. But I think it's a viable process.
That he was trapping all of the anger and the resentment and the
disappointment, whatever he was feeling. He was repressing it. You talked about that sort of thing. And he was totally healed as a result of unlocking.
Right. Much of what's being described here is actually part of, you know, just a lot of psychotherapy in general. It's not in any way specific to necessarily neuroscience and so on. I wanted, before we close, to make you aware of some of Danielle's work. I first began to think about inviting Danielle when I read an article about her in The New Yorker in May of 2014, which is called Partial Recall. It's on the net, and a whole bunch of articles there as well. There's the film that Danielle is talking about is also of the Ripple Project, where they came to her parents' house, is also available. So I avail you all to check out the work she's done. I've certainly found this fascinating conversation, and I'm delighted you were here to join us. Thank you very much.